Good evening. Welcome to Left, Right and Center. I'm Vishnu Shom. Relations between India and Canada are now in a deep freeze after the tit-for-tat expulsion of diplomats following allegations by the Canadian Prime Minister of an alleged Indian hand in the death of the Khalistani extremist Hardeep Singh Nijjar. Delhi has categorically denied the allegations, and so far Canada has not shared any proof at all, a point their opposition leaders are pointing out. Significantly, New Delhi has issued a stern travel advisory a day after Canada updated their advisory for travel of their citizens to India. India's message for Indian nationals in Canada is clear. Exercise utmost caution. There are growing anti-India activities in Canada. At half past the hour, with the landmark Women's Reservation Bill clearing the Lok Sabha, we bring you the voices of a cross-section of leading Indian women, all non-political for a change, who speak about the significance of what has happened. But first, we'll begin with the latest as far as the travel advisories are concerned. After Canada's travel advisory, India has hit right back. We've issued an advisory for travel to Canada. The advisory says that Indian nationals should exercise utmost caution. It's an advisory which has been given to students. Remember, there are thousands of Indian students studying in Canada. India says that there are growing anti-India activities in Canada. This advisory has been issued after Canada warned citizens about travel to India in their advisory yesterday, which was essentially the same as it was earlier on, but some would suggest that the timing, no coincidence at all.
Prime Minister Trudeau needs to come out with all the facts so Canadians can make a proper judgment on them. A strong statement from the Canadian opposition leader Pierre Poilievre after Justin Trudeau claimed India had a hand in the death of Hardeep Singh Nijjar, a Canadian citizen who Delhi has identified as a long-time Khalistani separatist.
I think the Prime Minister needs to come clean with all the facts. We need to know all the evidence possible so that Canadians can make judgments on that. I think we need to see more facts. The Prime Minister hasn't provided any facts. He provided a statement, and I will just emphasize that he didn't tell me any more in private than he told Canadians in public, so we want to see more information. We need to have the evidence that allowed the Prime Minister to come to the conclusions he made yesterday. I would have to have more evidence to make a judgment on that.
Poilievre's statement comes at a time when Canada's closest allies in the Five Eyes group have expressed concern at the allegations but have not issued any joint statement condemning Delhi. The White House has said, "We are deeply concerned about the allegations referenced by Prime Minister Trudeau earlier today. We remain in regular contact with our Canadian partners." The British Foreign Secretary has said, "All countries should respect sovereignty and the rule of law. We are in regular contact with our Canadian partners about serious allegations raised in the Canadian Parliament." Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, in his first remarks after his statement in Canada's Parliament, now says that he's not looking to provoke India.
"We are not looking to provoke or escalate. We are simply laying out the facts as we understand them, and we want to work with the government of India to lay everything clear."
Back home, BJP leaders, furious at Trudeau's claims, which resulted in a tit-for-tat expulsion of diplomats, say Canada's support of Khalistani extremism on their soil is akin to India backing the movement for an independent Quebec in Canada, a long-standing issue in Canadian politics. The BJP National Vice President Jay Panda has tweeted, "In the spirit of friendship with Canada, we in India must consider facilitating an online referendum on the Quebec independence issue in gratitude for their allowing Khalistani separatists to try the same on Canadian soil." For now, relations between Ottawa and Delhi have entered a deep freeze. Trade talks are on hold, and the focus is now squarely on Justin Trudeau and whether he can back his claims with any evidence. New Delhi has already said the allegations are bogus. Vishnu Shom for NDTV.
Well, joining us now, Jay Panda, the BJP National Vice President. Thanks, Jay, very much for being with us. Do you believe that the lack of evidence thus far provided by Canada is absolutely glaring? Without that evidence, there is no credibility to anything that Justin Trudeau has said.
Without a doubt, and as you know, our MEA has issued a very strong rebuttal to that. And not just a rebuttal, today there has been a very strong travel advisory because of the very real risks that are faced by Indians there. due to the hate crimes that have been going on, and these are being tolerated by the Canadian authorities. I mean, of course, there's a history to this. Canada has sheltered terrorists, not just Khalistani separatists, but of other kinds also. But we have been affected in India because of planning that has happened from there. But also, hundreds of Canadians have died at the hands of these Khalistani terrorists, such as in the bombing of Kanishka. But what has been happening in recent times is mind-boggling. You know, they've been allowed to put up these big hoardings asking for calling with death threats to Indian diplomats. They've been threatening people. They've been threatening Indian Canadians who are there who don't agree with their very violent means and extremist positions. And the Canadian Prime Minister's statement has been questioned by other Canadian leaders, because you can't make this sort of allegation without evidence. And clearly he's getting isolated. He's not getting support across the world for this.
You know, you tweeted, and of course sarcastically today, but I found your remarks interesting when you said that Canada allowing Khalistani extremists onto their soil, operating in the manner that they do, is akin to India allowing Quebecois secessionism, their leaders, to operate from India.
Yes, you know, of course my tweet was worded sarcastically. But it is based on truth, and it is based on realpolitik, because just imagine if we in India were to facilitate a referendum about Quebec wanting to secede. You know, they don't allow referendums for Quebec's independence movement, while they allow these Khalistanis to conduct these fake referendums on Canadian soil. Now, if we were to allow that, can you imagine what would happen? And there have been media reports earlier this year, for example, in the Politico, which have pointed out that the sentiment for Quebec's separation from Canada, independence, is growing. The percentage of people who want that has been growing. Can you imagine, you know, there are elected Canadian lawmakers who stand for Quebec's independence, and they've been going around meeting other global leaders in Europe. I would be perfectly happy to meet them and understand their point of view. How would Canada take that?
So, Jay, there's been a travel advisory, as you know, issued by Canada. Now, India has issued a similar travel advisory, you know, using, in a sense, similar language. But I think the point that has been made by India is that in as much as Canadians say that there is a threat of extremism on our soil or terrorism on our soil, we have concerns about the safety and security of Indian nationals in Canada?
Without a doubt, Canada has been exposed as sheltering these terrorists and others as well. You know, there are books like No-Go Zones by Rahim Kassam, which point out the Canadian authorities' laxity about appeasing and tolerating and pandering to these terrorist organizations and individuals. But, you know, in India, under Prime Minister Modi's leadership, there has been a transformation. This is not that same old India. This is an India today which, during the pandemic, ran the biggest vaccination campaign in the history of humankind in the shortest time. We helped more than 100 countries with vaccines. Subsequently, we've helped a dozen countries with financial aid. We have become the fifth largest economy, growing the fastest, soon to become the third largest economy. The whole world is vying for friendship with India. And India wants friendly relations with the entire world. Even the two or three countries who consider themselves as rivals who still want to have trade deals and friendship with India. So it's bizarre what the Canadian Prime Minister is doing. And the only likely answer can be for very narrow domestic political gains. He's compromising Canada's foreign policy.
And yet, Jay, and this is the part which is so terribly unfortunate. We have such very close ties with Canada, students, Indo-Canadians, the family link for generations. And yet there's this tiny fraction of Canadians who are extremists who've undermined this entire relationship. And the Canadian government hasn't seen through that.
You know, Canada has had Indian immigrants from about 100 years ago. But we have had bumps along the way. There have been examples where people of Indian origin have not been treated right in Canada. But the reality is, today Canada is a multiracial, multicultural society. We've had very friendly relations, like you pointed out. But these Khalistani separatists represent a tiny fraction of the Indian diaspora who are in Canada. The reality is that it does reek of a hangover from a colonial mindset for Canada's leader to be lecturing to India. Well, you know, Canada itself is not pure as the driven snow. Canada itself has acquiesced to operations where they've taken out terrorists in other countries, by other Western countries. And even though we have very strongly rebutted the allegations that the Canadian Prime Minister has made, they shouldn't be behaving like this. So this is not an India which will be lectured to by a hypocritical Western leadership that has some kind of a colonial mindset.
Now, Canada has reached out to their closest allies in the Five Eyes group, the Australians, the British, and the United States as well. But none of these countries have actually come together to issue a joint statement. They've all said in separate statements that they are concerned. They want to see the investigation through. But the fact that they've not come together, there's been no universal condemnation, I would suggest has to do with the fact that Canada hasn't released evidence so far. How would you look at that?
I think if you read between the lines, Canada's Prime Minister has painted himself into a corner. I think he's isolated Canada because no one wants to, spoil relations with India. You know, India as a rising economic superpower is being wooed by the entire world because it's a win-win scenario. We are not hostile to any other nation. But what is happening is, if you see the statements coming out from these other G7 countries to which Canada belongs, they're getting pro forma statements, but nothing beyond that. And so I think it's actually bad for Canada's own positioning in the Committee of Nations in the world. But more than that, the same kind of statements can be made about Canada sheltering terrorists, and the travel advisory that India has issued is based on truth. It is rooted on actual facts. We have seen the threats. We have seen the hoardings calling for death to Indian diplomats. This is not how a civilized country behaves. This is not how a developed country behaves. It's bizarre what they're doing.
Now, Canada's primary opposition leader, he's issued a statement. You would have seen that. He wants to see more evidence. In fact, that statement, as opposed to backing or endorsing, in a sense, what Trudeau had to say, seemed to question, the initial statement made by Justin Trudeau in the Canadian Parliament.
Indeed, I saw the statement by Mr. Poivre, the opposition leader, and he's right, because how can you make such extreme allegations without citing evidence? And how can you ruin relations with the nation with whom you have so much in common in maintaining geopolitical stability, not just in the Indo-Pacific, but around the world? The only reason can be that that Mr. Trudeau is running behind in the polls, and perhaps this is one way he hopes to create a schism and try to get some votes of people that stand for Khalistani separatist causes. But, that is extremely short-sighted. I don't think it's good for Canada. It's certainly not good for friendship with India. And I can't imagine what good will come of it.
Well, joining us now, Ambassador Vivek Kadju, Brahma Chilani, Seema Sirohi, and Terry Milewski, who's a retired CBC correspondent, has written extensively on the Khalistani movement. Ambassador Kadju, let me come to you first. There's international law which says that extraterritorial, assassinations, killings cannot take place. And of course, India has categorically denied our involvement in anything that's happened in Canada. But isn't it a bit rich for countries like Canada to be accusing India of these things when so many of their partner nations and perhaps Canada itself has been involved in activities, covert or otherwise, in other countries? For example, Afghanistan.
I think let's leave the Afghanistan situation apart. The Canadian Prime Minister has made, even though he has hedged his language, a very serious allegation against us. Now, he has not backed it with any evidence. In a matter relating to a murder, which is a criminal act, there is a certain legal process. It is not a political process that is involved. It's a legal process. And if he suspected certain individuals, then the right thing would have been for Canada's legal process to move ahead, file whatever is their equivalent of a first information report, thereafter make investigations, criminal investigations, and then take the matter to a legal conclusion. Here we have a strange situation where the Prime Minister of Canada gets up in his parliament, and please note the words he uses. He says credible allegations. And then he says potential link. What does this mean?
Yeah.
It's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
And there is never in the history of independent India has any country apart from Pakistan, which is a rogue nation, accused India of carrying out extraterritorial acts of the kind the Canadian Prime Minister is hinting. Therefore, I think ab initio, the Prime Minister's move was incorrect. Now, one other point, Vishnu. If I have seen reports attributed to sources, that is, of course, from emanating from Canada, that information was gathered or intelligence was gathered from many countries. Intelligence is a different thing altogether. Intelligence is in matters relating to espionage, etc. Here, a murder is a criminal act. It has to lead to a legal conclusion. There is nothing that he has laid out. He says that we have laid out the facts. His own leader of the opposition has, as you played out, said that we are waiting for the facts. One last thing. Yesterday, when I saw the clip of the proceedings in the Canadian Parliament, where the leader of the opposition also spoke, and all the parties rallied round the Prime Minister, I thought that perhaps the Prime Minister had his team of investigators with him, and they had briefed the political leaders, the opposition leaders, leaders of other parties, on at least some of the facts that they claimed to have on this issue. But the leader of the opposition says that he had nothing except for this.
Yeah, exactly.
So it is unfortunate, and this is the last thing that I want to say to you. It is unfortunate that in Parliament, instead of calling out the Prime Minister, the leader of the opposition rallied round him. What is that message? What is the message that goes out to India?
No, I get that. One second, Ambassador, let me just keep the
Canadian political class.
I get your point.
I
just need to keep the strike rotating. Seema Sirohi, in just the last little while, the U.S., the National Security Council spokeswoman, has come out with a statement saying that this is a serious matter. We support Canada's ongoing law enforcement efforts. But the fact of the matter is that it's interesting that they say we support Canada's law enforcement efforts. As of now, this seems to suggest that Canada has not provided America, their closest ally, with the so-called overwhelming evidence that they claim to have. So did Justin Trudeau not get ahead of himself? Because if this evidence had been suggested, had been provided to Washington, you wouldn't have had statements saying we support Canada's ongoing law enforcement efforts. Of course they would. Who wouldn't?
Right. So the very fact that Prime Minister Trudeau wasn't able to get a kind of a joint statement from the Five Eyes countries reflects the fact that they're not comfortable with this, you know, public statement that he made. Investigations apparently not complete, but on the point of whether they have the evidence or not, we just don't know. One would assume that Trudeau would not do this purely for domestic political reasons and must have something in his pocket. But if he doesn't, he's really wrecked the relationship, not just with India, but potentially with his Western partners as well. Because don't forget that when just earlier this year, when Chinese interference and that whole question came up in Canada, the opposition was hopping mad with Trudeau because he didn't share the information in time. He was forced to. So is he overcompensating by, going public on the India issue? We just don't know. So far, all he's got is boilerplate statements from other allies.
All right. Terry Bilewski, I think the larger picture over here about how this has actually gone on for decades in Canada is what we aren't talking about enough on this program. This extremism of Khalistani extremism in Canada has gone from strength to strength. It does represent a threat to Indian nationals. We're talking about Indian diplomats now, but Indian diplomats and their families have been threatened from the 90s onwards. Is this not a serious concern that Canada has just done nothing about?
It is a serious concern, and there's no reason why Indians should not be concerned about it. It's been extremely serious threat in Canada for 40 years now, ever since even before the Air India bombing, the Kanishka bombing of 1985, going back to the time when Pierre Trudeau, Justin Trudeau's father, turned Indira Gandhi down when she asked for the extradition of the man who later became the Air India bomber. We'd all be better off if Pierre Trudeau had said yes to that request. But the point is that in the present day, there is a very serious threat from the Khalistani movement, which has been normalized. It's been accepted as perfectly legal, no problem at all. You can put up posters glorifying the Air India bomber, for example. You can run a diorama, a reenactment, celebrating the assassination of Indira Gandhi in 1984. You can run that through the streets of downtown Toronto, if you like. And you can put up these posters calling Indian diplomats killers and basically painting targets on their backs. All of that has been normalized, and it's a serious threat to peace and security in Canada. However, I draw the line at the idea that Canada is supposed to wade in and say you can't have a democratic referendum, even if it's completely devoid of any threat of violence. What is the Canadian police going to invade a Sikh temple, a gurdwara, and say you cannot have a free vote on something you are peacefully exercising your right to have a vote? I don't think that's reasonable. I think India goes a little bit too far in its demands, and it needs to focus them on the threat of violence. That's the line that they should not be crossing. That's the line that they are crossing, and Canada lacks adequate legislation to deal with that to the same extent that our allies, the British, for example, 17 years ago, passed a law making the glorification of terrorism a crime. And Canada has done nothing on that score and needs to act on that. The Indians are right about that. But they go too far, I believe, in trying to restrict the freedom of speech. No Western democracy. Indians need to accept this, I believe. No Western democracy is going to abolish freedom of speech to please the Indians. It's not going to happen. It's not a winning strategy for the Indians. In order to get around this crisis, first, two things need to happen. First of all, the Canadians need to come up to fill the gaping gap in the Prime Minister's presentation. I mean the complete lack of evidence. Bear in mind that that evidence, lack of evidence is so complete that the police have said nothing about who shot Mr. Nidja. They haven't even got the shooters, never mind who paid them. This is about who paid them. Who was the hand behind that assassination? Was it just a gangland killing? Well, the two punks who shot him had probably didn't even know who it was. It was a contract hit. It had all the marks of a gangland contract hit. Now, if that's the case and the police don't know who the shooters are, how do they know who paid them? How do they know who was behind this? So Justin Trudeau has a lot of work to do to save his own neck from embarrassment if he cannot come up with evidence in short order. And the other thing that needs to happen is the Indians need to play ball on the investigation. It's all very well to the Indians to say, to point fingers, and I would support them on this, at Canada's indulgence and pandering to the Khalistani movement in Canada, all fine with me. But we need to see the Indians cooperate with the investigation in the way that Canada requires. What if the missing piece of evidence has gone back to India? What if there's somebody that the Canadians would like to interrogate who's gone back to India and the Indian government will not produce him? Well, now then things would start to look a little different, wouldn't they? And all of this talk of, you know, rappers canceling their concerts and travel bans and travel advisories and tit-for-tat expulsions of diplomats, all of that would seem like a distraction compared to that. So Prime Minister Modi needs to think about this. Both sides need to get out of the corners into which they have painted themselves and deal with the real issue. Who killed Nijjar? If it was not, if Trudeau is wrong, prove it. If he's right, prove it.
All right. Brahmachalani, what is the likely international impact of this on India? A lot of the nations that Canada is speaking to also happen to be our closest allies of late.
Well, first, the issue about Canada harboring terrorists and extremists is not just about India-Canada relations. It also holds implications for international security. A day may come when Canada-based Sikh militants carry out a major terrorist strike in a third country. Let us not forget that there are few takers for the Khalistan idea in India's Punjab. But Canada's British Columbia province has become the global hub of the Khalistan movement. British Columbia is home to nearly 24 prominent Sikh extremists who are wanted in India for committing acts of terrorism. So it's against this background, and given the, also the background that Canada has been the launchpad for major acts of terrorism, the Kanishka bombing being the most prominent example, and now we are seeing under Trudeau growing Sikh separatist activity. It's not just Sikh separatism. It's okay to advocate Khalistan. It's covered by freedom of expression. Even in India, the Indian government, for example, negotiates with separatists, be it in Nagaland, Manipur. In the past, India has negotiated with separatists in Mizoram and in several other states. So advocating secession by itself is not a crime. What is criminal and which is being tolerated in Canada is endorsing violence and glorifying terrorism.
Sure.
For example, if you look at Trudeau, he's heading a minority government that depends for its survival on support from the new Democratic Party leader, Jagmeet Singh.
Yes.
Now, Jagmeet Singh's background, he, as a lawyer, defended Sikh militants who not only were espousing the cause of Khalistan, but actually were also accused of acts of violence. And he has participated in events where speakers have endorsed political violence as a legitimate tool to achieve Khalistan. Now, his principal backer, you know, the guy who's keeping his coalition government in power, is, to say the least, a Khalistani sympathizer, if not a Khalistani advocate.
Right.
So it's in this background, I think, that what's happening in Canada holds important implications, not just for India-Canada relations, but for larger international security.
You know, it does indeed. Brahmachalani.
May I have one sentence? I'm glad that just one sentence, please.
One sentence, Ambassador Kachu, because I'm out of time on the segment. Go ahead. Yes.
I find it passing rich that India is being asked to cooperate in this matter by our Canadian colleague, when Canada, for the last 30 years, has refused in case after case to either extradite people who are known criminals or to even restrain them. This man, Nijjar himself, was an accused in India.
Yeah.
What did Canada do? Did it send him to us? So I think the Canadians, all Canadians, need to do a great deal of introspection before asking India to cooperate. Where has there been cooperation from Canada for the last 3 decades and more?
The Kanishka bombing is a prime example.
The Kanishka case was a shocking case. I think the Canadians should be ashamed of themselves and for the manner in which their government handled that case.
All right, Ambassador Kanju, you make your point very, very strongly over there, and I think that does reflect the sentiment of many in this country. I'd like to thank you all very much for joining us. Thank you very much indeed. We're going to move on, and we're going to take a look at the historic Women's Reservation Bill, which has cleared the Lok Sabha today. It has to clear the Rajya Sabha. That'll likely be just a formality. We decided that we're going to speak to non-political voices about why this is so significant. That's coming up after this short break. Welcome back. The historic bill providing 33% reservation to women in parliament and state assemblies was passed in the Lok Sabha today after hours of fierce debate. It's the first time the bill was introduced and passed in the lower house. The bill was passed with the support of 454 MPs. Only 2 MPs voted against it. The bill will be presented in the Rajya Sabha tomorrow, the day 4 of this special session. Parliament saw some sharp reactions, however, to the bill in favour and against. While the former Congress chief Sonia Gandhi demanded a reservation for other backward classes and immediate implementation of the bill, Smriti Irani said her government has made women count and that women matter. What we can bring you are a couple of those reactions.
How this country is governed, of course, Lok Sabha and Vidhan Sabha, but beyond that, they are the 90 secretaries of the Government of India. 90 people, secretaries, are responsible for managing the core of the Government of India. And I ask myself the question, how many of the 90 people come from the OBC community? Ye jo Hindustan ki sarkar ko chalate hain, jo budget ko chalate hain, in mein se OBC kitne hain? मैं आपको जवाब देना चाहता हूं. हिंदुस्तान के सेक्रेटरीज 90 में से सिर्फ 3 ओबीसी से हैं.
और आंकड़े अगर आपको चाहिए, आंकड़े अगर आपको चाहिए तो मैं बता देता हूं. सुनने के लिए आप बैठे नहीं हो. भारतीय जनता पार्टी के सांसद में 29% 85 सांसद ओबीसी कैटेगरी के हैं. कंपैरिजन करना है तो आ जाइए. और मान्यवर और मंत्री, मान्यवर मंत्री भी 29 ओबीसी कैटेगरी के. मान्यवर, सस्ते चुनावी वादे करना और पॉलिटिकल भाषण करना, दादा नए सदन में तो उम्र के हिसाब से कुछ करिए. मान्यवर, बीजेपी के ओबीसी एमएलए 1358 में से 365 है, 27% है. ये सभी ओबीसी का राग आलापने वालों से ज्यादा है. मान्यवर, बीजेपी के ओबीसी एमएलसी 163 में से 40% है. ये 33% की बात करते हैं. मान्यवर, चुनावी भाषण करना बहुत ठीक है, कोई एनजीओ बना कर दे देता है, चीटियां आकर पड़ जाना ठीक है, भैया मन से पिछड़ा वर्ग का कल्याण करने का काम हमारे नेता नरेंद्र मोदी जी ने किया.
Well, we thought we'd move away from the politics to actually look at what this signifies for women in India. We are joined by a very special guest, Naina Lal Kidwai. Thanks, ma'am, very much for being with us. Do you believe that this is genuinely a red letter day for women's rights in India?
I think so much cause for celebration, Vishnu, that we can actually finally see the path for women reservation. Now, I should just start by saying I was one of the folks, at least in terms of corporate board quotas and reservation, way back in the early 90s,
that was really not for quotas, because I always believed that women would get there in their own right. And for those that got there in their own right, the fact that there was a quota sometimes detracted from the merit that went with their having made their own way. And that reservation or concern does remain. But I also know, and hence a convert to having quotas, is that it takes much too long. Look what happened with corporate boards in India. We remained at 6% as recently as 2013. And it was only once corporate law action mandating one woman on a board happened that we saw board representation go up all the way to 18% as it is now. Still low, but at least an increase into the high teens and going up every day. So what we have in terms of reservation is the ability to finally catch up, and hence the reason to celebrate. I was actually looking at some of the statistics of other large democracies. Mexico at 50% representation already. South Africa just north of 45%. Most of the European countries in the 40s. We are really far, far behind. Only Japan looks lower than us at 10%. So we have to catch up. And the only way we can catch up and ensure rightful representation, this is not about reservation, but about rightful representation, is by having quotas and by bringing a reservation bill in.
Do you believe it'll take some time? I mean, it will take some time. Is that a concern for you? There'll be a census, the entire delimitation process. Does that worry you?
Oh, certainly. I mean, you know, I don't understand this process completely, but what I've understood is that it would be nearer 2029 that we would see this having come into action. So I hope that once there is a convening, as there appears to be across parties on bringing this bill in, that there can be more attention given to how we can bring this in as quickly as possible. So, yes, it is a very long pathway. Having said that, I think the work we must do to get to it should start right away. And by that, what I mean is the empowerment of women leaders, the training that may be required, the leadership at grassroots levels that exists, but giving them the confidence to stand, to win votes, to understand what that process is about. And equally for the law that is to be developed, to be one which is enabling. And what I mean by enabling is, so yes, so you tick mark that the numbers in parliament, but to ensure that the decorum of parliament is one that permits that voice to be heard, that we do not see the treatment of women in parliament to be anything other than exemplary. And for that, it's not just the training of women and the leadership they need, but of the men that represent us as well. So how does parliament look in terms of, you know, should there be a creche? Are there enough women's toilets? What is the treatment accorded women in parliament? I think all of this will require attention. And I'm hoping that as the law actually moves forward, we address both the the environment in which women operate, but also how that representation should be firm and capable.
You know, we talk about our demographic dividend being our biggest benefit as we, you know, we're now the largest country in the world. But a large link to that, of course, is getting women into the formal workforce. If that doesn't happen, we will not achieve what we can with this huge dividend. Do you believe that the inclusion of more women in parliament would be, you know, an inspiration to involve women in other sectors as well?
You know, I was just looking at a study which looked at Nepal, which put in 33% reservation. And the study was about what that has done for Nepal. And the study has actually demonstrated that beyond just the 33% reservation, the role of women in society, the empowerment that came therein, the various ways in which they have measured how women are delivering and performing in society and how their role changes are all very positive. So there is no doubt that when you create this body up at the highest level, these are the, at the legislative level, that those role models in their very own ways engender a whole bunch of others to follow in their footsteps. But equally, there is a flow down of policy, and everything that happens in Parliament sees passage only through a gender lens as well. So if it is a policy on education, on health, that there is horizontally an application on what does it do for women? How does it advance the cause of women? And I think that is the change which becomes very important. So beyond the numbers, to make sure that it's the voice of women towards empowerment of women that happens, and the discipline that must come with it.
Absolutely. Look, it's always wonderful speaking to you, ma'am. Thanks very much for being with us on this program. We'll be joined now by another very special guest. Reena Dhaka joins us. Reena, how do you look at these developments in Parliament? Is it just for the benefit of our political class, or do you believe that this would have a huge benefit for women across India?
So I do believe this is a red letter day for women in India, because there's been a lot of news, and I also learned that India is not the only country in the world where the women in the parliament are very marginally represented. So as I've understood, we have about 7 to 14%, I'm not sure which percentage is correct, of women elected representatives. And it's high time, folks. I understand that this will not go into action ASAP. It will take another season, I think 4 to 5 years, to get tabled in the literal sense of the word. But the process has started, and if the wheels of this journey are slow, so be it. But we have to get onto this wagon.
Reena, will this be an inspiration for women in different walks of life?
Yes, I believe in the sense this has to be, there has to be representation from both sexes in the world we are in today, because that is the unit value of our life at core, be it a home, be it a workplace, anywhere. So similarly, in running a country or the affairs of the parliament, we must have the role of female and women representation. Yes, it is important that the people who elect the female leaders, they bring in to limelight heroes who will play a big role and significant journey in our lives and the lives of many others in the times to come.
One more question, Reena. Do you believe the induction of more women in parliament will result in an improvement in the conduct of our parliamentarians? Less fighting, less screaming, more debates, more conversations, more decisions?
Yesterday, I was watching from on top. They invited us to be a part of the first day of the parliament. And there was uproar, there was fist fighting, and apparently there was drama on blood on the table also, which we couldn't see, fortunately. And I hope either it'll turn the women into warriors and more feisty creatures, or the men will turn around and learn how to have a more civilized code of conduct.
All right, Reena, thanks very much for sharing your thoughts. It is an incredible day for India. It will take some time, but true representation of women in parliament, women being at the heart of our democracy, that will certainly be something that will benefit countless Indians. We're out of time on Left, Right and Centre for now, this short break.